New T-Mobile unlimited plans might be garbage. Bigger, better, non-exploding phone batteries might be coming next year. And who will embarrass the tech elite now that Gawker is gone? It's our last tech news today, live from the Brick House, so stick around.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1581, recorded Friday, August 19th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit Wealthfront.com/TNT and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's Wealthfront.com/TNT.
And by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents with outrunning out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more.
And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at QuickenLoans.com/TNT. Hello, welcome to Tech News Today. This is the last Tech News Today in this studio before we move to our fancy new place.
Well, sorry, is this TV going with us?
I'm assuming everything is going with us.
Oh, okay. All right.
Everything's
not. It's probably the bricks behind us that are not going with us, though.
Dang. No, those bricks behind us are not going with us. But this is a show, if this is your first show, this is a show we talk about the tech news, everything that happened today, a little bit of yesterday, because we're starting early in the morning. Not a lot has happened, but some has happened.
Yeah.
I am Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. I'm a little sad. A little sad that we won't be surrounded by the Brick House studio. I mean, seriously, I've been in this studio since it opened, so quite a long time. What is it? 4 or 5 years at this point. What is it?
July 24th, 2011.
So, you know, a little more than 5 years, and we're going to a new studio, so that's exciting. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to miss looking out and seeing all of these other sets. I guess there'll be different sets that we'll be looking at, though.
Yeah.
So it'll, you know, same, but different.
Right, exactly.
All right.
Should we get to the news?
Yeah.
Yesterday, T-Mobile and Sprint announced that unlimited data plans are back, my friends. However,
finally,
a look at the fine print. Don't get too excited, Jason. Oh. The fine print makes these plans not look so rosy after all. First, if you want to play less because you don't need unlimited data, too bad. Those cheaper plans won't be offered anymore, at least by T-Mobile. Second, do you like to tether? Sorry, you cannot. Third, the new unlimited plans throttle video to 480p. I could go on with this fine print, but suffice to say, if you are planning on changing plans on any carrier, take a good look at what they're offering before you sign up. I know everyone makes fun of me for still being on Sprint. The truth is I'm just too busy to change it to something else. I will eventually. I recently changed my Sprint plan to one that throttles my speed after I use up our allotted data. I thought that would be a good idea. I'm like, we don't use so much, and we can go for 2G if we use up all of our data. Don't ever do that. It will feel like you're dead if you have to be on 2G. You can't do anything. So don't.
I mean, at this point, I kind of assume anytime they say unlimited, it's not. And not just T-Mobile, but just in general. I mean, the outliers are when it actually is unlimited. But I feel like, so, you know, at this point, I've been beaten into the ground with just the fact that unlimited never means actually unlimited. There's always all sorts of limits there. Weird that T-Mobile's going in such the opposite direction on its pricing, because for a long time, T-Mobile and Sprint both have been, at least as far as the major carriers in the U.S., been the value brands. And I think, I have to look into it to compare closely, but I think T-Mobile's kind of entry in their postpaid plans is actually one of the most expensive single line you know, entry costs for just one line. So that's quite a change for the end carrier.
Yes. Well, T-Mobile One is the only plan it will offer.
Right. I know. That's crazy. So yeah. I'm prepaid, and this doesn't affect prepaid. Thankfully, I'm happily paying the $30 a month unlimited data. But so I've experienced what at least on T-Mobile, air quotes unlimited actually means. When you get to 5 gigs with that plan, you end up still getting data, but it's the 2G speeds, which for all intents and purposes, it's basically like you're not getting any internet. And no. I'm not even overstating that, because there, any time that it's actually happened, it's been worthless. It's been literally worthless, and I cannot even get to the thing I'm trying to get because it's just so slow. It times out. It just doesn't work.
And you're used to that. Like, so, you know, literally brought me to tears. I know.
Ooh, did it really?
Literally.
Close.
literally.
You use the term literally like T-Mobile uses the term unlimited.
Right.
I get it.
It brought me to unlimited tears.
There we go. So T-Mobile, $25 per month more will remove the standard definition video limit. So if you really want unlimited with HD video content, you have to pay more, $25 more. Tethering, I did see that they offer tethering to some capacity.
Well, you have to pay extra.
You can add 5 gigs of tethering for $15 per month. The asterisk there is that, from what I could tell, it's 2G speeds.
Yeah.
No. Which, again, goes back to what I was just saying. That's basically worthless. LTE tethering is $15 extra per month. Oh, I see. So it's the LTE tethering that's extra, $15 per month. Tethering available at 2G speeds, which is basically nothing. It's just kind of a crazy turn for T-Mobile. And it just reminds me, there's an image that I put in there because... right underneath the article. This was a joke from, I don't know how many years ago, where it's this graphic that kind of breaks down, you know, it's kind of an illustration of what net neutrality could mean in the future, where you pay your base cost. And then you've got all of the, you know, you've got the entertainment package, which gives you access to YouTube and to, you know, whatever other video services, iTunes, you've got your music package or whatever, that's an extra fee. And some of what we see out of what T-Mobile is doing here kind of moves you in that direction, right? Like, we started with Binge On in the beginning. It was, and a lot of people kind of gave it a pass because it's like, well, it's customer choice and it's, you know, it's optional or whatever. Well, now T-Mobile's all in. Now they're saying Binge On, we're going all in on it, and we're kind of, we're moving it into this paid structure where now if you really do want better access to things, you do have to pay more. That's kind of a dangerous precedent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't like it. I'm unhappy.
You're also not a T-Mobile user. You probably won't be jumping to T-Mobile anytime soon. But you're on Sprint.
I'm on Sprint, but I'm on Sprint because I have so many phones that I'm still paying for. But allegedly, someone might buy me out of my plan. I don't know who that will be.
Buy you out of your
That's
plan?
That's what Owen Odokta told me. Hmm. I believe him, so.
Okay. Interesting. Let me know how that goes.
They'll do that. They're like, we want you so bad, we'll, you know, pay this much money.
Yeah, it's also inconvenient to be switching and all that kind of stuff. So there's a whole lot of other elements to that. Mm-hmm. Pandora held out for a long time, but it might be near the unveiling of its on-demand streaming offering as early as next month, according to the Wall Street Journal. Tell me if you've heard this part before. It should launch with a $10 per month streaming level for unlimited consumption of music. There we go. It has the current $5 per month Pandora One tier. For ad-free playing in the traditional Pandora sense. That's going to be modified to add more perks, apparently. Things like the ability to skip more songs, listen offline, which is a nice bonus feature there. The report also shows that Pandora is looking to expand into new markets, but that could get tricky. You know, labels want control over what songs would be played in that free tier, and they worry that control might be a little more difficult to maintain in some of the new areas. You're a Pandora fan.
I am a Pandora fan. I am one of the 4 million people paying $5 a month.
Not many people paying for Pandora service compared to a lot of the other services.
No, but I like the surprise of it. I like introduction to new music that I've never heard. I'm also an Apple Music subscriber, but I don't find myself using it very much. But when I was throttled, that was when I had to use Apple Music, because Apple Music, of course, lets me download music and then I can listen to it while I'm running, which Pandora didn't used to. But then this plan might allow listening. So
if Pandora gets full streaming service for $10, then would you up it at $5, get rid of Apple Music, and then be all in on Pandora? Because it carries the kind of recommendation engine that you like from Pandora One, and then, you know, the on-demand stuff when you need it.
Maybe, and it'll, you know, more skipping, that ability I like.
Sure.
But I do the family plan for Apple Music, which is $15 a month. I don't know if Pandora would have a family plan.
I have to imagine certain members of your family might not be very happy about losing their access to Apple Music.
They might not. That's true. And they might
if you were to say, we're getting rid of Apple Music or we're replacing it with Pandora, deal with it. They might not be super stoked about
Pandora
that.
Also integrates with the Amazon Echo, which I use on a regular basis, too. So.
Right. Cool. Well, you know, Pandora really, I mean, it's a no-brainer that they would eventually get into this because everybody else is doing this. You know, the challenge that they face right now is that there is no easy way or there is no way for users necessarily to go there and say, I really like this Katy Perry song. I want to listen to it on repeat forever. You can't really necessarily do that with Pandora. So what does that mean? People hear a good song there and then they go to another service to do that with, much in the same way that you're talking about how you're using this in Apple Music. So so it makes sense for Pandora to kind of keep you locked into their solution.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mark Gurman is spreading some Apple Watch rumors over at Bloomberg. Actually, he's just quoting his mostly reliable sources. We're the ones spreading these rumors. Gurman says Apple Watch 2 will be announced this fall, possibly at an event on September 7th. It will include improvements to health tracking, but it will not be untethered from your iPhone. The new version of the watch won't be able to connect to a cell network due to battery life concerns. The new watch, he says, will have GPS, which is a game changer for runners. That's really nice to have that, not to have to run with a giant iPhone strapped to my arm. I would like that because I got to have everything tracked. If my health app doesn't know that I'm running, I'm essentially not running. That's what.
Basically, none of the gains, none of the fitness gains are even happening if you're not wearing it. Yeah.
Yeah. So the cellular chip will, you know, if you're not a runner, the cellular chip would allow you to download info when you're away from your phone, which would be great for some people. I don't know. Those people who are separate from their iPhone for whatever reason, I don't know why you would ever be separated from your iPhone. That seems wrong.
When you're wearing the watch to do fitness and you say you leave your phone home, it's still able to log a lot of stuff while it's detached, right? And then when you reconnect, kind of sync it over and stuff?
It knows my heart rate and but it doesn't know it doesn't have a GPS, so it doesn't know that I've run 6 miles,
right?
Which is what I really need to know.
So that's a pretty meaningful update, I would say, at least in the fitness side of things. I always struggle and go back and forth on whether these watches need cellular connectivity. Like, I understand it's the next step, you know, like, why have it tethered when you can just have it all inside? But, I mean, battery is always a consideration, and when you talk about adding a cellular antenna into something that didn't have it before, that's going to come at the expense of battery. At the same time, LG Watch Urbane LTE, it's an Android Wear device. I think it was the first one to have LTE capability inside the watch, so you could do just this. I mean, reviewers that spent time with that said the battery life was actually pretty good. So there are ways around it. Maybe it's battery optimization, you know, power savings optimizations or whatever. But I think Apple's just not necessarily in the business of downgrading its hardware usually on these, you know, kind of major iterations on its product line. So,
right. And other arguments have been that they don't want people to get rid of their iPhones. You know, they just they don't want to make something that's better than an iPhone. I don't think now that the Apple Watch has been out for a year and a half, I think nobody thinks it's better than the iPhone.
Yeah. Nobody's going to, I would imagine, like, think that they want to get an iPhone, but then be like, oh, but the Apple Watch has connectivity, so I don't need an iPhone. Yeah. I'll just use my watch for everything. Like, that's probably not going to happen. Somebody might, but they'll be sorely disappointed when they try and do that. Mm-hmm. You know who would love for Apple to have mobile support would be the carriers, because they'd love to have another avenue of selling these, you know, packages, especially if it has the word Apple in the deal.
So. Unlimited data on your Apple Watch.
Yes, you too, for only $30 a month. Unlimited.
Itch.
Speaking of, unlimited light. Speaking of battery, I might just have the solution to Apple's woes. Mm. Most would agree that bad battery performance can sour the experience of a phone or a watch, in this case, significantly over time. You've got a great phone in so many ways, but if it only lasts 9 hours through the day or doesn't even get you through to the end of the day, what does it matter? MIT spinoff Solid Energy claims its lithium metal batteries can pack twice as much energy as a traditional lithium ion battery in the same size, meaning two times the length of battery power. This is not the first time we've heard of emerging battery technology that had potential to blow current solutions out of the water, but the company plans to release the batteries into the marketplace starting this November, actually. And this is, you know, they've been working on this for quite a long time. Their struggles with heating issues, basically in the past, batteries like this would require to operate around 175 degrees, and that's obviously not great for something that you keep in your pocket. Also short-circuiting as a result of that heat. So basically, the team has developed a coating of solid electrolytes to get this to operate at a room temperature. And, I mean, they're close. They're starting this November. They're going to start with drone batteries and expand outward from there.
That's exciting. Also, they say they could use this for electric car batteries.
Yeah, which would be right. Great.
It's twice as energy dense, but then just as safe, which is great.
That's the important part. That is not going to kill you because it explodes.
Or burn you or maim you.
And pretty much any injury whatsoever, they probably don't want. So drone batteries starting this year, commercialized for smartphones and other electronics next year. And then EV batteries, like you're talking, in 2018. So when you take the Tesla Model S, for example, it currently has a 280-mile range. Suddenly you're getting 560 miles out of a charge. That's like, that's next level, you know, for EV because that's what my Prius gets, you know, on a single tank of gas. So then you're getting to the point to where it's no different from what we're used to. And that's super important. I just know that I've heard these stories before where you read them and you're like, whoa, they've broken through the barrier for batteries. And soon we're going to start seeing them. They never seem to have a date attached to them. It's always like, we figured this out in the lab. Who knows when we'll see it, if at all. And we never end up seeing it. So this gets me excited because it really sounds like might actually see it in the marketplace starting in a couple of months, which is crazy.
Yeah. Well, when Gawker shuts down, who will be left to challenge the tech gatekeepers? Will Arimas from Slate is here to give us some hints. But first, let's take a minute to thank Wealthfront, the sponsor of this episode. You invest for the long term for you or your family's financial health, but trying to do it all by yourself, especially the right way, is complex and time-consuming. Luckily, there's Wealthfront. Traditional advisors charge huge fees between 1% and 3% of what they manage. With Wealthfront, you pay 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points, zero commissions, and no hidden fees. That's less than $5 a month to invest a $30,000 account. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. With Wealthfront's new portfolio review, you can see if your portfolio is at risk, how diversified your investments are, what you're losing to fees. You can even minimize your taxes. You can get started investing today with just $500. It only takes a few minutes to sign up. It goes right to work, monitoring your portfolios around the clock and taking action as soon as an opportunity arises. Wealthfront is transparent and accessible. You can view and track all your accounts in one place. Wealthfront can track both your Wealthfront and your non-Wealthfront bank and brokerage accounts, so they'll provide you a summary of all your assets. You can also see every trade that Wealthfront makes on your behalf in your dashboard, on your desktop, or with their mobile app. Now, we've heard from many of you that you've used Wealthfront. You love it. You love how it can diversify your portfolio and buy stocks from in-demand companies, like some of the companies we talk about every day, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, all of this commission-free. Wealthfront recently also introduced their 529 college savings plan that allows you to invest after-tax dollars, much like a Roth IRA, and you can save for your child or your grandchild's higher education expenses. Wealthfront manages almost $3 billion in client assets, and it's growing rapidly every day. So what are you waiting for? Invest in your future today with Wealthfront. Visit wealthfront.com/TNT to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation they recommend for your profile. And just for TWIT listeners, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge for life. So join the many TWIT fans who have seen huge success with Wealthfront and claim your offer today at wealthfront.com/TNT. Yesterday, Gawker announced that they will be shutting down next week. Their other operations like Gizmodo, Jezebel, Lifehacker, and others will continue on under Univision, which bought them for $135 million. But Gawker.com will be no longer. Joining us to talk about what this means for tech journalism, and particularly the honest coverage of the tech elite, is Will Arimas from Slate. Welcome, Will.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. Thanks so much for coming on. So you write that Gawker's work was often petty and cheap. Much of it was not reporting at all, but rather, quote, aggregation of news reported elsewhere, filtered through a lens of righteous fury. But you argue that there are still many good reasons to fear the fact that billionaire Peter Thiel was able to essentially sue them out of business. Now, what about Gawker's coverage of the tech industry was so important?
Well, I think the more powerful and secretive an industry is, the more you need fearless people who don't give a crap about the consequences and are going to go after it and try to dig up the dirt that they're hiding. And, you know, Valleywag was Gawker's Silicon Valley gossip blog. It was on again, off again over the years. When Valleywag wasn't active, Gawker did some of this itself. Gizmodo sometimes did a little bit of muckraking around Silicon Valley. But there really are few, if any, other publications out there whose mission has been to expose hypocrisy on the part of the tech titans who increasingly control all our information. And I think that's unfortunate. I mean, whatever you think of the approach, the editorial approach or the tone, the repertorial style of Gawker and Valleywag, I think that they will be missed because, you know, the relationship between tech and the media is generally so cozy. And there are all these barriers to getting information about the tech industry. And there are all these incentives against digging up dirt that, you know, it's going to be hard to find a replacement for the type of work they were doing.
So you bring up Gizmodo. I mean, they historically got in a lot of trouble with Apple, you know, posting pictures of a phone, and then they were cut off. Like Apple cut off access to them. But those reporters from Gizmodo are going to still be working. Do you think that they're going to take up this void?
I think it'll be interesting to see who takes up this void. I don't think Gizmodo is really constructed to do what Gawker and Valleywag did, you know, which is to talk about the personalities and the people. Gizmodo is great. I love Gizmodo. And maybe they will do some of this. I mean, Sam Biddle, who was the famous lead writer for the revived version of Valleywag that people remember from a couple of years ago, you know, he was at Gizmodo before he was there. And Gizmodo does have some people right now who are doing some sort of investigative stuff. I mean, they've got Michael Nunez there who found the disgruntled Facebook contractors who would talk about the Facebook trending section and the allegations of bias and sort of expose the way in which Facebook was using humans when it you know, was sort of purporting to be using algorithms. So I think Gizmodo can do some of it. There was news today. I think some of the people who worked at Gawker.com, which is closing down, are moving over to Deadspin, which was originally a sports blog, but maybe broadening its mandate. At least one is moving to Gizmodo. And then you've got all the alumni from Gawker and from Valleywag. I mentioned Sam Biddle. Natasha Tiku was the editor of that sort of latter day version of Valleywag. She's an excellent investigative reporter, and she is working at BuzzFeed now and doing great work there.
Well, Sam Biddle left for The Intercept, which is a place that we think of as doing a lot of investigative reporting. But they're in some ways beholden to the big tech companies, as is BuzzFeed. I mean, is there anyone? I mean, as Slate. I mean, you guys got your start at Microsoft, right? I don't really know what this connection is still, but I mean, is that part of the problem as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the problem. This is sort of the easy pickings part of the problem is the ownership issue, where you've got. You know, you've got some really visible coziness between tech and the media when you've got Jeff Bezos of Amazon owning the Washington Post. You've got Pierre Omidyar owning First Look Media, which includes The Intercept. You've got companies like BuzzFeed are relying on VC money from the tech community. That's a sort of an easy place to start. And yes, Slate was started by Microsoft back in the mid-90s as an experiment in online journalism. It's now has no relationship to Microsoft or the Washington Post, actually, which owned us for a while. But more insidious in some ways and deeper in terms of its effects on media coverage of the technology industry is the way in which all media, and not just the tech media, but all media now rely on these tech companies, Facebook and Google and Twitter and Snapchat, to distribute their work to their readers. The tech companies have become the intermediaries between publishers and their audience. And so if you don't do your work in a way that that is conducive to Facebook's newsfeed algorithm or Google's Google search algorithm or you know, in a way that Snapchat approves of enough to strike a partnership deal and put you into Snapchat Discover, then you're at risk of being cut off from your readers. I think that, you know, that's a harder relationship to untangle. And it's really, I think, actually more of a problem than the ownership, because at least when Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, everybody knows it. And you can put in place particular editorial safeguards and controls and firewalls. And then you can have, you know, the New York Times, knowing that the Washington Post is owned by Bezos, can go really hard on Amazon, as in fact they have. David Streetfeld and others at the New York Times have written some really tough investigative stuff about Amazon.
Now, you know, obviously we're talking a little bit about a site whose kind of goal is to, you know, kind of look beyond the news that we normally get from a lot of these places and into kind of the news behind the news to a certain degree. I mean, what about alternatives to, you know, publications or sites dedicated to this? What about things like, you know, Twitter or social networks, satire, like Silicon Valley, HBO? Do you think they play a role in this at all?
Yeah, that's a great point. So I brought this up on Twitter yesterday before I wrote the piece, actually. I asked, you know, now that Gawker's dead, who's gonna embarrass Silicon Valley? And it's sort of half joking, but half serious. I mean, obviously, just embarrassing Silicon Valley in itself probably isn't a that noble of an end. But, you know, who's going to write the stories that Silicon Valley doesn't want written? Who's going to expose the hypocrisy, that kind of thing? And I think, you know, one of the responses that I got from several people was, look, this happens on Twitter now. You know, when Gawker started, when ValleyWag started in the mid-2000s, there was no Twitter. There was no social media, really. Blogs were, you know, the only outlet for this kind of thing. Now you can have reporters. You've got reporters like I shouldn't even name names because there are so many, but you've got reporters who cover tech in a relatively straight-laced fashion for mainstream publications, but then they sort of moonlight on Twitter as the people who poke fun at the individuals behind these companies and, sure, and who make fun of the products. So I think that's part of it. And yeah, I think actually the HBO show Silicon Valley, the more I thought about it, the more I think that has sort of taken up some of the void that was left by the demise, the second demise of ValleyWag a year or two ago. And in fact, if you watch HBO and you're familiar with, if you're familiar with all the stuff that ValleyWag covered over the years, a lot of the plot lines in HBO are like ripped straight from ValleyWag. I mean, obviously there are plenty of other sources there too. But Dan Lyons, who was a ValleyWag editor for a short time, was actually a writer on Silicon Valley. So, you know, the satire is there, but who's digging up the new dirt that, you mm-hmm. know, that will fuel future seasons of Silicon Valley? That's a harder question to answer.
Yeah, and you also write about oppositional reporting, that in general and traditional journalism had oppositional reporting, but tech journalism doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, so there are sort of two strands here. I mean, I don't want to overstate the sort of nobility of what ValleyWag was doing. I mean, a lot of what they were doing was cheap shots. I mean, it was funny, it was entertaining. Some of it, sometimes they had real scoops. Sometimes they broke stories that were of genuine public interest. A lot of times, I think what they were about was just sort of puncturing the facade that, you know, the we're making the world a better place facade that Silicon Valley is so successful at projecting, and getting to the sort of flawed humans that are behind these companies that are foisting their ideals on all of us. But there's also another strand that is somewhat different, and that is serious, sober, investigative reporting. Thankfully, you know, we still have some of the big mainstream legacy publications, The Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post to some extent, who have reporters who don't give a crap whether they're invited to the next Apple launch event or whether they get put on Snapchat Discover. They've been doing the hard work of investigative journalism for years and decades, and they keep doing that. And they do that sometimes in the tech industry. You look at Wall Street Journal breaking the Theranos story. I mean, that was really essential reporting. It's a different kind of reporting than ValleyWag did. And obviously, Gawker and ValleyWag's death doesn't prevent that from continuing to happen.
Yeah, you said you didn't want to name names, but you do in the story, and it's a great list of reporters. And you know, I think about Kashmir Hill is one of the names that you mentioned from Fusion. She's great. I'm a huge fan of hers. And, yeah, I mean, she uncovers these stories without being petty as, like, Gawker does. So it's people are able to do it, and I hope they continue to do it. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Will. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Will Oremus is a reporter at Slate. He is on Twitter, fighting the good fight, at Will Oremus. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. All right. A few days ago, we talked about Postmates, and we got an email from a viewer who worked at Postmates.
Works.
Currently, and for obvious reasons, asked not to be named. He writes, I've been delivering for them in the Miami market for a while now, often listening to TNT while I drive. I can say with absolute certainty, a large majority of the time, the suggested prices for items that the customer sees are incorrect. Usually not by a lot, but it can add up with multiple item orders. Also, the amount a customer is charged can vary based on how far the restaurant is from the drop-off, but I'm not sure of the details. They aren't very upfront about their financial practices. I just saw one slide about the breakdown and how I'm paid during the onboarding session and never seen references to the details. Never seen reference to those details since. If it has changed, I have not been notified. I'm sure if I asked or scheduled an appointment with one of the people at the office, they would go over it with me, but it would be nice if Postmates had financial transparency on by default. And yeah, they might be, at some point, they might be pressured to have some sort of, at least a little more financial transparency to kind of explain how they come up with, these amounts if it continues to be out of the boundaries of what people who are using the service think that it is. They have to kind of explain that at some point, I imagine, or else they might risk losing customers.
Absolutely.
Up next, Russ Pitts joins us to run over a few of the big announcements out of Gamescom. But first, let's take a minute to thank Epson. They're the sponsor of this episode. Epson's revolutionary cartridge-free EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. The EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer doesn't use ink cartridges. It features an awesome, innovative, refillable ink tank, earning it the title of CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. No more out-of-ink frustration. It includes up to 2 years of ink equal to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages. You can save up to 80% on ink with low-cost replacement bottles. It's powered by Precision Core printing technology. It has auto two-sided printing, a 30-page auto document feeder. It's easy wireless printing from tablets and from smartphones. That's not always so easy, so they figured that out. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value. With Epson's EcoTank line of printers, you'll have the freedom to print without running out of ink. The Epson EcoTank system was named the 2016 Small Biz Windows Printer of the Year. You can see why for yourself. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, your office, or work group prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the Epson EcoTank printers. That's Epson.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson for their support of Tech News Today. The Gamescom conference is underway in Cologne, Germany, and there have been some cool gaming announcements to come out of the event. Joining us to discuss some of those announcements is Russ Pitts, president of Flying Saucer Media. How's it going, Russ?
It's going well. How are you, sir?
Doing fantastic. It's good to have you here this morning. So first up, Konami revealed Metal Gear Survive, and fans of the series, it sounds like, have been a little worried about the fact that this is the first entry in the series without its creator, Hideo Kojima, on board. So is there reason to be worried? What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's reason to be worried, because I feel like that series, Kojima-san's wackiness really is what sort of kept that series afloat.
Yeah.
I've never been a fan of the series myself. I don't think they're necessarily good games, but I think you definitely you play a Metal Gear Solid game or a Metal Gear game, and you just expect the wildest, craziest stuff to happen. And Kojima never disappointed on that front. So it's going to be really interesting to see what this new team does. How many of Kojima Productions team is actually involved in the project? Where they're taking it. There's a lot of question marks, and I'm not sure the footage they released at Gamescom really answers those questions. So we'll just have to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to take a. I mean, I was a huge fan of Metal Gear Solid back in the the PlayStation days, and I played some of the sequels, not extensively, but enough to just kind of see what it was about. But I my regular game playing habits kind of fell through the floor when I started working a lot more. So unfortunately, I don't have a whole lot of time to play through those games. But the thing I always really loved about the series was the whole kind of stealth aspect, that it wasn't just like move, shoot, you know, go, you know, all that kind of high paced action. It was a lot slower, a lot stealthier, a lot more intention behind your actions, as opposed to just get out and destroy things. And from what we're seeing here, it's really moving in the action direction to a certain degree. There's zombies, there's wormholes. I mean, it almost seems like this is just a different game set in the Metal Gear universe, would you say?
Yeah, I would. You know, you have to think that there's been some desperation, maybe for a Call of Duty level hit or a Battlefield level hit. And watching this trailer, that's what it says to me. It says, yeah, you know, it says if I was going to put Big Boss in a Call of Duty, it would probably look like this.
Sure. Maybe we'd have more success if it wasn't pegged as a Metal Gear game. Also revealed at Gamescom is the trailer for the upcoming Resident Evil 7. And I don't know, is this at least a little more pleasing to fans than the Metal Gear sequel? What do you think?
I think there's probably less controversy,
yeah,
in a way, but the Resident Evil series has had its own kind of flavor of controversy, in sure, that it's been so uneven. It's been like a roller coaster ride. I think you talk to different people and they'll tell you that different entries in the series have been their favorites. Some people I talk to, you know, go all the way back to the PlayStation. They just flat out prefer the original game's pacing and style, and mm-hmm, you know, the directions they took in I want to say Resident Evil 4 made it, you know, a little more actiony, made it more palatable to a broader audience, I think, but it actually alienated some of its fans. So I'm curious. What I've been looking for from the Resident Evil series has been a mix. I think, you know, they have stuck to some of their hang-ups from the original design, like typewriters and healing plants, for a little too long. And I think their direction in taking it a little bit more mainstream has been muddied. So I'm hoping this is the Resident Evil game that everyone can agree on, but I don't know how likely it is.
Well, one thing that's very interesting to me, just with all the kind of virtual reality stuff happening this year, is that this is going to be supported with PlayStation VR. Think that's going to be pretty transformative. I mean, I feel like the horror game genre is ripe for the picking when it comes to the immersion of virtual reality. So it seems like a perfect fit.
Yeah, those kinds of experiences do very well in VR. And you look at this footage and you have to think that that's what they had on their mind. VR as a whole, I don't know. I've been a skeptic, honestly. I think we're still way too early for that to be a major purchasing drive for consumers. But I think folks who have already invested in VR, you know, having it on the PlayStation's Morpheus project is great. That's a low cost solution for people who are curious about VR, who already have a PS4.
Right.
Maybe this will be the thing that really drives that. I don't know. As an observer, I think it's 50-50. You know, I think there's a lot of great experiences, but there were a lot of great experiences on the Kinect too, and it didn't really catch on. I think console makers and game makers in general are really struggling to move the medium past, you know, the controller stage. And
sure,
this new wave of VR, it's got a lot to offer, but it's still a lot to ask to people. Yeah. Me personally, I have a hard time putting something on my face. So whenever I play a VR, I have friends who want to show me their VR games. And of course I want to see what my friends are working on, but I have to overcome that sort of psychological thing of putting a giant thing on my face. And it's not easy.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, there's immersion in the way virtual reality creators have intended. And then there's immersion the way South Park creators have intended. That's immersion that we should all be afraid of. Smell us about the Smell-O-Vision news, Russ.
Yeah, so you know, South Park, they're what they are. The Stick of Truth games was one of the, I think, one of the gems that survived the crash of THQ and went on to be released. And it's a fine game. Ubisoft picked that up, and it's a fine game. And so they've got a new Fractured But Whole coming out. And I've actually heard the South Park creators say that they believe video games may be the sort of next evolution of that franchise. I don't know if they're getting tired of making TV shows, but it seems like they're enjoying translating the South Park formula to TV to video games. So I guess the next step is the Nauseous Rift, which is a device that you, as you can see here, you put on your nose. That's Richard Mitchell from Games Radar Plus. You put the device on your nose and it allows you to smell farts. So
with the closed captioning saying that is really horrible.
Yeah, you could actually see his eyes watering there.
Okay, we'll have to blur that out.
I'd like to blur all of that out of my brain, actually. So that is a real thing, but you can't really buy it, right?
As far as I know.
It exists in the world, obviously. We saw it, and I mean, that was real.
Somebody his smelled it. Really watering, we saw it. Somebody smelled it.
You can't buy it.
Right, thank goodness. That's right. Yeah, it would be fun if they sent that out as a demo. You know, occasionally a game publisher send things out to games writers. If that happens, if I hear of that being sent out, I will let you all know and try to get my nose on one.
I mean, please do share it with the rest of you. Why don't you? Smell-o-vision really does seem like the next evolution of VR. So they could be onto something. This could be a footnote in the long-standing 10 years from now history of smell-o-vision. This is where it began, and that's an incredible footnote right there. Finally, you have a new project in the works. I want to talk with you about that. I love the idea behind it. Tell us a bit about Stage of Development Indie City Edition.
Yeah, so Stage of Development is my series of web videos about indie game makers and people who are in the video game community. This year we're doing Stage of Development Chicago. So we just got back actually a couple days ago. We were in Chicago meeting with indie devs. That's William Cheer, who is making a game called Manifold Garden, which he calls a tribute to physics for the last 400 years. If M.C. Escher made a game, it would be Manifold Garden. Those are his words, not mine. So we talked to Young Horses, who worked on the Octodad game, and actually had to struggle a bit. They made Octodad. They were a group of friends at college at DePaul, and they formed the studio to release a retail version of the game that they created as students. And then it was so successful, they spent a good 6 months or more trying to figure out what to do next, if they would even do anything next, right? You hear a lot about indie game success stories, but you don't hear a lot about what happens when your game is so successful that it gives you, you know, stress and anxiety about having to follow it up. So we talked to them about that. We were there for the BitBash Indie Game Festival, which is a really unique festival they do in Chicago, where it's like a block party, but they have video games set up and people come and you know, there's beer and dancing and it's unlike any video game event I've ever been to. It was really, you know, Midwest, low key. People were just hanging out playing video games. It was super great. That's my dog.
Your dog thinks it was pretty fantastic too, I can tell.
Thanks.
I watched a little bit of the video, and especially the with the creators of Octodad, because all the Resident Metal gear zombie thing is great for lots of people, but it's not my thing.
I really want to see the game where it sandwiches all the three things that we talked about prior to this into
exactly.
one single
yes.
game.
Yes, but I love Octodad. My kids love Octodad. It's weird and fun, and I was so interested in the people behind it. Like, who makes a game about like getting an octopus moving him around, and you know, and then he gets married, he has kids. It's a wonderful story. So I really enjoyed that. If you know, if that's any indication of what these documentaries are going to be like, it's fantastic, even for people who don't love games.
That's the idea. You know, I've met so many people who make video games, and just the thought that there are, you know, video games are made by people in the first place is kind of foreign to some folks. You know, these video games show up, and I think what gets lost in the creation is how many people are involved and how much of their own passion and life experience people actually put into these video games. You know, we talk about Octodad. You know, the real sort of subtle message, I guess, of Octodad is this basically, he's a father who has a secret, right? And he's hiding this secret from his family. And it's a silly, goofy game, you know, where you have to control his limbs to do ordinary things, and it just makes a giant mess, and it's hilarious. But, you know, when I played that game, it really made me feel a little bit like somewhere in there is this creative idea of, you know, being a part of a community and having people who you love and who love you, and, you know, having this secret that you're keeping from them. So that's the kind of thing I like to talk to video game creators about and sort of get to why they do what they do. You know, where do they come from with their ideas, and what is that process actually like? So we were just in Chicago for a week. We're going to do, the series is going to be four. I think we had enough to do actually five or six episodes of Stage of Development Indie City. And, you know, we have the footage. And so now we're just trying to kickstart the money we need to finish the films. I think we are also considering, and this is an idea still in progress, but we're also considering cutting the six episodes into one whole and releasing it as a full feature film. And nice. That's something that will definitely be helped if the Kickstarter funds.
Excellent. So where can people get involved? How can people get involved?
You can go to bit.ly/stagedevchicago. That'll take you to the page, the Kickstarter page for the project. You can see the teasers that y'all were just showing there. We just released a third teaser trailer from BitBash today. That'll show up on the website here momentarily. You can see me talking about the project, read a little bit more about how we're doing it, where we plan to spend the money, why it costs, what we're asking. Strange thing, this stuff actually costs money to do.
Yeah,
weird.
Well, and you've got a level of quality. Like, I was watching through the pilot, the pilot that you have posted on the site, and, you know, about 12 minutes of cut together footage and everything. And it's just everything, like, you've just got a great style with it. You know what I mean? It's not sandwiched together, thrown together. It's obvious that this takes time. It takes money, and it's really good stuff. So bit.ly/stagedevchicago to check into Stage of Development Indie City Edition for yourself and to pitch in.
Yeah.
Great stuff, Russ.
Thank you so much. It's rewarding to do, and I feel like everything I've done in my career so far has sort of led up to doing this work. So I'm really, really excited to do it, and I hope folks can help us finish it.
Excellent. Right on, Russ. Thanks for joining us today, man. Where can people outside of bit.ly/stagedevchicago? Where can people follow you on the internet?
Oh, you follow me on Twitter @RussPitts.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm super active on Twitter, so that's the best place to hear from me or talk to me.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Russ.
All right, thanks, Russ. Have a great morning.
Thank you all.
All right,
enjoy
best
the
of luck.
Last show at the studio.
Thank you. Best of luck with the Kickstarter.
TNT's fan of the day is Derek from Cary, North Carolina, who sent us an email to say, I have you playing in the car on my daily commute.
Oh,
the video
yeah.
is rolling, but I promise I'm not watching, only mm-hmm. listening.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, I'm too busy texting with my work phone to watch the TNT podcast. Wink. Hashtag kiddingish.
That's not funny.
No, we have a story about texting and driving coming up just for you, Derek. But first, if you want to show us how you watch TNT, you can easily do this. Derek sent us an email. You can post it to Google+ or Twitter or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT. We will find it. We love to see those videos.
And yes.
Tweets. And after the break, like I said, Jason is going to show Derek a better way not to text and drive. But first, let's take a minute to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, the sponsor of this episode. The last time we refinanced our house, I had just broken my wrists, and it was very difficult to dig through files or paperwork with only one working wrist. It's not fun with two wrists. And do not even get me started on all the things I had to sign with my left hand. It was not pretty. Even with two wrists, the mortgage process is never easy. It really seems old-fashioned in many ways, but Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. It's fast, it's powerful, it's completely online. Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. If you hate searching through stacks of old paperwork, don't do it anymore. With Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and your pay stubs at the touch of a button, helping you get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your unique financial situation. With Rocket Mortgage, you can do all of this on your phone or your tablet. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. So if you're looking to refinance your mortgage or to buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/TNT. That's quickenloans.com/TNT. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support.
All right. People do stupid things while driving, as in pretty much anything other than actually driving. Sure, there are exceptions that we all understand, like, you know, you have to turn on the radio or something like that. But let me just say this in no uncertain terms. Never drive with your feet while using your phone with both hands. I'm surprised I have to say this out loud, but a concerned driver caught this video of another driver doing just that. And even more concerning, they tracked this driver for a good 20 minutes the whole time, kind of like trying to get their attention, honking, trying to get her to stop what she's doing. All they got back were smirks and continued cell phone use while foot steering. And I think we have the video. Well, yeah, we have. Oh, I see. So you can see right there, I mean, feet up on the steering wheel, text messaging from the driver's seat. No big deal. At least 20 minutes. This is bad. I can't believe we have to say this, but this is not okay.
How about just never drive with your feet? Never drive with your feet while you're texting. Just never drive with your feet. Never drive with
your
feet.
Don't do it. Don't do it. It's a bad idea.
Steering wheel. Use your feet for the pedals, not for the steering wheel. Don't drive with your knees either. No.
This
is why we need self-driving cars, people. We need them now. We need them today.
No, we need to not be distracted while we drive. We need to focus on what we're doing, which is driving, and not killing people because we were stupid. Period. In this case, by the way, there is little the police can do after the fact, even though they have video footage of it happening. Like, there's she, you know, tried to contact the police after the fact, show the video, whatever, and there's like, there's nothing they can do. She did log the driver's license and everything, but
Who took the video?
I think those people that just appeared
there. If
there
were two people,
they were driving,
not the driver.
Good.
You're sounding suspicious.
Look at it. It doesn't look like the driver's seat.
I don't know.
It's holding
I think she probably like zoomed in. You know how you can zoom in on the phone
using
and
her feet to drive while she videotapes a person using their feet to drive.
And that's why the other driver didn't stop, because she just smirked. She's like, we see eye to eye.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Say goodbye to the Brick House, everyone. Starting next Monday, we'll be coming at you from the new East Side Studios. It's been real. Just look around. Turn around every now and then. I get a little. I don't know what song is appropriate for here, but there we go.
Yeah. So we'll be in our new studio, and it will be different and the same. We'll be the same. We're not changing.
We're not changing.
No.
We'll still be us. Mm-hmm. I hope you'll still watch. If you're hoping for us to change, I'm sorry. We are who we are. But the studio will change. And I'm looking forward to it. So we will be doing that on Monday. We're also on Twit this weekend. Mm-hmm. So Sunday, there's going to be kind of a big live stream thing moving from the Brick House en route to the East Side Studios. We'll arrive there, and then we'll do Twit. It's going to be a bunch of us, Megan, myself, Father Robert, of course, Leo, and possibly even more. So we're going to be doing that on Sunday, so tune in for that. But TNT, the show you are subscribed to here and watch every weekday, you'll still get it every Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can still email us at tnt@twit.tv. That's not going anywhere. You can leave us a short voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. We aren't closing down the voicemail line. It's still up. And we still have a Twitter account, at TechNewsTodayTV.
And if you are subscribed to the show, very little will change at all.
It's true.
And if you just listen to the show, nothing's going to change. So.
That's true.
If you want to subscribe to the audio or video podcast, go to twit.tv/TNT. And you can still find me on Twitter. I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director, Kara Cole. Thanks to Mario for the words on the screen. And thanks to you for talking tech with us. We'll see you all on Monday in our new digs. Bye.